Hey, 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 Go Heroes. If you're tuning into this episode and haven't yet listened to the previous episode, number 21, I strongly recommend you listen to that one first, as this episode is part two in my feature on fluoride in drinking water. I also encourage you to head to lauratrotter.com/fluoride, that's F-L-U-O-R-I-D-E, to enter your details so you can get your hands on my free e-guide summary of this three-part feature on fluoride in drinking water. This download clearly presents a summary on the case both for and against fluoride in drinking water, plus contains a review on water filtering systems should you decide to head down that route. So head to lauratrotter.com/fluoride to get your copy. Now, in the previous episode, episode 21, I shared with you that like many Australians, I grew up drinking fluoridated drinking water because it was present in the water supply to our house, and we were told, I guess by our local council, dentists, teachers at school, and parents, that it was essential for strong teeth and to help prevent tooth decay. I've lived in various cities and towns now in four different states of Australia. Some where water supplies have been fluoridated and some where they aren't. Now for the past 11 years, I've lived in a town where the water isn't fluoridated and the incidence of tooth decay in young children is extremely high. On an aside point, I've personally witnessed the rise and actually the explosion of the bottled water trend over the past two decades. And as an environmental engineer, I'm acutely aware of the waste issues that single-use drink vessels alone are having on our environment, not to mention the resources used in the manufacture of the bottles. So in my endeavours to steer people away from drinking bottled water over the years, however, I've found that the biggest barrier to people drinking tap water is the presence of fluoride. So when I started looking into this topic of fluoride in drinking water, it very quickly became obvious that it's a really heated topic and there's plenty of information out there for both sides of the debate. But I really want to get to the bottom of this, if not for my own health and my children's overall and dental health, but for my listeners, and that's you guys, as I know so many of you are confused and don't know what to believe when it comes to fluoride. Now, my style is to gather the information for both sides of the issue to help you make an informed decision that best suits your family. In the previous podcast episode, where I chatted with my guest, acclaimed dentist Dr. Agim Heimer, we covered the history and reasons behind adding fluoride to drinking water and the case for water fluoridation. You heard this perspective directly from a medical professional who is deep in the trenches facing the issue of tooth decay in our population day in and day out. Today, we're switching to the other side of the fence and I'm chatting with toxicologist Dr. Peter Dingle. Now, Dr. Peter Dingle has spent the past 30-odd years as a researcher, educator, communicator, and author, formerly an associate professor at Murdoch University in Western Australia. Dr. Dingle has written more than a dozen books on living well. Dr. Dingle has regularly appeared on state and national media. He was the presenter on the award-winning SBS program Is Your House Killing You? And appeared regularly on ABC's Can We Help? Dr. Dingle is also the grandfather of the acclaimed Living Smart program and the creator of the Star Foods food rating system. So recognised as one of the most informative and entertaining health speakers in Australia, Dr. Dingle aims to cut through medical and health myths to give you the real facts on evidence-based wellness. He is known for his straight-shooting style, sense of humour, and the occasional magic trick or juggling display, none of which you'll see in this podcast of course. So in part two on this feature of fluoride in drinking water, where I'm chatting with toxicologist Dr. Peter Dingle, we discuss why adding fluoride to the drinking water supply is not in the public's best interest, according to Dr. Dingle, why adding fluoride to drinking water is a 1950s mentality and a band-aid approach to tooth decay, and what we should be focusing on instead, why Dr. Dingle believes that adding fluoride to the drinking water supply is mass medication and an ethical issue in itself. We chat about the health implications of fluoride consumption on humans for the current generation and future generations. We discuss why the safety factor of fluoride in water supply should be increased, why all water needs to be filtered, including rainwater, why reverse osmosis isn't the best water filtering process, why drinking water out of plastic bottles is an environmental and a health issue, and on what may seem like a totally unrelated topic, but it's not, why we need to increase breastfeeding rates in Australia. Okay, this episode is a long one, so I hope you've made yourself comfortable. Now let's dive in. Welcome to the EcoChat podcast. I'm your host, Laura Trotter, and I'm here to show you how you can create an ecoceptional life you love without compromising your lifestyle. Tune in for inspiring interviews with real-life eco-heroes, plus my own theories, thoughts, and tips for sustainable living. I'm all about making green mainstream, and I'd love to help you on your eco journey. So let's get started. Thanks so much for making yourself available to chat today, Peter.
That's an absolute pleasure.
Before we get into the nitty-gritty of fluoride, can you please just give us a snapshot of your career to date and what inspired you to head into the field of toxicology in the first place?
Okay, look, in most cases, it was all purely accidental. You know, life's got these amazing twists that they take you on, and I've just followed them all the way, and they keep changing and I keep twisting with it. But you know, it really started back in high school, and I was all enrolled to go into phys ed, and then a last-minute decision, I saw this poster said environmental science. So I looked into it, and I ended up enrolling and doing a degree in, a Bachelor of Education in Environmental Studies. Mm-hmm. Taught for a few years, travelled for a few more, came back, and then what was really interesting, in the two units in that those environmental studies that excited me most was one about nutrition in the environment, and the other one was about toxic substances in the environment. So right back then, you know, 19-year-old, I didn't know what they were, but they're the things that kind of gelled for me back then. So it wasn't until about 30 years later, well, not 30, but when I was early 30s, I enrolled in uni again, did another degree in environmental science this time, more science involved in it. And again, the unit that struck me most was all about nutrition, environment, toxins, all of those ones. So again, I pursued it. So my honours degree back in the very early, late 80s, was in pesticide exposure in Perth homes. So, you know, my first foray, then my second foray was, which was my PhD, and that was all in exposure to toxins in the home. So my PhD was literally what you're exposed to in the home, with a particular emphasis on a chemical called formaldehyde. And just looking at all those other things. So everything from Teflon in the frying pans, fluoride related, to the water, to the food additives, to a mold, and you name it. My passion just took off. And at that stage, I had already begun teaching a unit at Murdoch University called the unit was called Pollutants and Toxicology, and that expanded out over the next 21 years, which was my career, and I literally just got excited. And what happens is I get excited about a topic, e.g. fluoride, e.g. pesticides, e.g. nutrition, and, you know, and I just pursue that for a while with my students, my PhD students, my honours students, my research students. We've had hundreds of years of research done by our students over the years. And the thing that excited me most about being an academic was that the students were my best teachers. I gave them the I gave them the one line: don't trust me, go out and do your research, find the stuff and prove me wrong, but don't just tell me I'm wrong, show me. Okay. And my students over the years, you know, 21 years as an academic researcher teacher, and I had huge classes, sometimes up to 300 or 400 second and third year students doing research, and they came back and they said, Pete, you know, This is what's happening here. This is wrong. Look at that. Wow, that nutrition stuff, that's wrong. Wow, look at that fluoride stuff. Hold on, that may not be. Look at this drug stuff, you know, to do with statins. Wow, look at, hold on. And my students got me to question it all. So they're the ones who made me or redirected me into my learning experience and saying, okay, I want to see the evidence. I want to see the science. And that is where it's taken me. And, you know, right now, I'm interested in all these areas. After 30 years as a researcher, I left university life 5 years ago, and I fortunately I get to do more research and writing. now than I did at university.
At university, I guess you had the team researching for you.
Well, I did have the team, but then again, you know, I didn't have as much time to use all that information to pull it together. So I was getting information and it was going into my head, but it wasn't getting anywhere else.
Yeah, and that would be, I can imagine that would be frustrating when you're so passionate wanting to get out and make some change.
Where I am now is, you know, I love writing. I love writing. So I've got 14 books. I got 14 books, and I'll be putting out another two this year probably. I've constructed a couple of workplace wellness websites I'm working with some companies on. You know, so I'm constantly writing, and that writing is condensing or coalescing all that information out of my head. And from the research papers I've collected and still collect and putting it on paper. So essentially that's where I'm from. That's where I've come from and my passion for all this. And the thing that drives me most, though, is I'm just sick of seeing people sick.
Mm-hmm.
I see people who are sick and everyone goes, oh, I wonder why. Rubbish. We know a lot of the reasons why people are sick. We know why, you know, there are many, many multiple reasons for cancers, and we can probably avoid 60, 70% of them straight away by making small changes. Neurological, neurobehavioral problems with kids, it doesn't matter, heart attack and stroke, our biggest killers, you know, we can probably avoid 90% of them over a period of 6 months if we took action. But there's all these strong vested interests, money involved, drugs, advertising, profits, and it obscures the real information. So my passion, what drives me, is getting my information, the information that thousands, tens of thousands of researchers and hundreds of my students have worked on, out into the public forum.
Great. Now let's get some of that information out there today, because you've got me fired up and I'm passionate as well. And I am keen to jump straight into today's topic. And we're chatting about fluoride consumption, in particularly in our drinking water supply. Now, I understand that around 90% of Australia's potable water supply is artificially fluoridated. Do you believe this is in the public's best interest from a health perspective?
Look, I don't. I don't. Mm-hmm. To me, before I get into anything to do with toxicology or anything like that, to me, there are some fundamental flaws in just principles, in basic principles, principles of toxicology, principles of ethics and morals and all these things. And the first one is that in the 1950s, the 1940s and 50s, we had this kind of DDT mentality. You know, we could add DDT, and they thought, well, we can eradicate all the pests around the world. And this mentality was, wow, we've got these great chemicals. Let's go out and spread them around and do it. And fluoride for me comes very much out of that era. Wow, you know, let's get – and the evidence on DDT controlling stuff was bad. What's really interesting about DDT, which links in with this in a sense, is that DDT wasn't banned so quickly because of its toxic effects. It was banned because it was ineffective. The way we used it, the way we abused it, it became inefficient, ineffective. Mosquitoes become resistant to it. So, you know, it lost all of its purpose. But then the toxicology over the next 50 years and still is showing that, hold on, we didn't consider this, you know, the 1,001 problems that it created. And it's still creating, you know, it's still found in your fat tissue, in your body. Laura, it's there.
I know.
And all of this stuff. So, you know, often these things we don't consider. So that historically it's a mentality that's wrong. And the second fundamental principle that I cannot believe with fluoride is, okay, you've got tooth decay. Now, I will argue that it doesn't help with tooth decay. And everyone's got their position on that, but I'll argue. Now, if it does though, let's have one thing. What causes tooth decay? If I asked you, Laura, I'm going to put you on the spot here. What do you think causes tooth decay?
Sugar.
Okay. Sugar is a part of it. Sugar is a very important part.
Not brushing your teeth properly.
Not brushing your teeth. Dental hygiene. And dental hygiene in Australia, interestingly enough, was extremely poor in the 1950s and 1960s. I know. I grew up in that era, okay? And it was really, really poor. And it's only been in the kind of the 70s, 80s, and increasingly that dental hygiene has taken over, so brushing your teeth. But the answer you said was sugar. And yes, sugar, but anything that forms sugar in the mouth.
Mm.
Now, That's all of your grains, all your processed foods, all your white breads, your cornflakes, your breakfast food, croissants, your all of those things, with your pastas, mm-hmm. all of those mainstays
are broken down
into sugar in your mouth. Yeah. And what we're really facing here is, okay, we've got a problem. We've got dental decay. So what do? Instead of controlling the things that contribute to it, we put a poison in the water. Now, that's, again, a 1950s, you know.
Yeah, it's a Band-Aid.
Strategy. Let's do that rather than control the sugar and the processed grains. Now, I'll take one step back. If we controlled sugar and processed grains, you'd reduce your risk of just about every single form of chronic illness by 50% overnight. So we know you can reverse diabetes, you know we can prevent it. We know cancers feed on sugars and live in an acidic environment created by the partial metabolism of sugar. So we've got all these things in there, heart attacks and strokes. It's not the fat. We now know it's not the saturated fats. It's actually the sugars in our diet contribute. So here it is. You want to get rid of tooth decay, heart attacks, strokes, cancers, right through to Alzheimer's, get rid of the sugar.
And the processed food.
And processed food. So why don't we? Because of money. That's all it is. It's money. It's too big a job for a government to tackle it. So rather than do that, let's put a poison in the water. Duh. To me, that is stupid. But, you know, they don't want to tackle the big issues. They're going to treat them around the little bit. And that means, okay, all of a sudden, oh no, one other aspect about tooth decay. Is that you can actually tooth decay is also a fundamental principle that's ignored is nutrition in utero. So when the mother in that first trimester, second and third trimester, when the bones are forming, but in that first trimester, the end of the first trimester, when the bones are being formed and the teeth are being formed and so on, you're actually locking down the matrix, you know, this protein, calcium, mineral matrix for the rest of your life. So we know that if mothers have poor nutrition, and I can tell you because I'm involved with lots of mothers groups and other around the place and through my daughters and my grandkids and stuff, there's a lot of poor nutrition. I can't believe how poorly 20-year-olds eat. I have met 20-year-old male and female. The majority of them actually don't eat veggies. So
the tooth decay I'm well aware of that.
The tooth decay problem in 20, 30, 40, 50 years' time is going to be 10 times worse than it is now. Not because of fluoride, because of nutrition.
Diet.
You can't, you know, and the problem, you know, that's going to contribute to all illnesses. So the real focus should be on nutrition in utero, in the womb, and in those first years, making sure, again, the stuff on breast milk, you know, feeding human milk, the advantages of it. It's just phenomenal. And yet we don't put that emphasis. It's, hold on, let's add a poison to the water. Let's take a drug later on in life. Let's do this and cover the symptoms rather than dealing with the issues. So my philosophy, you know, going back to some really simple principles here. Now, another principle is that of mass medication.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the other issue too without consent, I guess.
Yeah, and that's very, I suppose very apparent in Australia now with attempted mass medication through vaccines. All the principles of health around the world say everyone has a right to choose the water, the air, the food they eat from a health perspective, you know, a fundamental principle. Here we have governments, and by the way, less and less governments around the world are choosing to do this.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you look at the world, you know, you've got the US, which is the US just pushes everything. It's the least democratic society I've ever come across, the US. It's just crazy, you know. Australia. And then you've got most other countries dropping out over the last 20, 30 years. You know, places, Europe.
Yeah, I noticed that. Most countries in Europe have withdrawn.
Yeah, most of it. The fundamental principle in Europe and all these other countries is, hold on, we don't know enough and there's emerging evidence and people have a right. And so there's a dozen reasons, the same reasons I'm espousing now, to say that let's get rid of fluoride. And even some of them have said, well, let's tackle it from the cause, nutrition and sugars, those type of things. They're doing wondrous things, particularly I think it was Sweden who's rewritten their nutritional guidelines and said, they've turned it on its head to what we do, and they're on the right track. But going back, mass medication, you know, there are ethics and morals and values based in there that are ignored. and it doesn't give people a choice. It really doesn't. It's here it is, it's in the water. So if you want to do it, you've got to take it out. Well, first of all, you have to know to take it out. And in Australia, around the world, there is a group of people who know and actively try to take it out, and we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, we'll get down to that towards the end, yeah.
But the end product is the vast majority of people, and particularly in Australia, excuse the expression, the working class Australians, the least educated Australians are the people who get the highest exposure to all toxins. All toxins. So not just fluoride, because they don't take steps to avoid it, but all of the toxins because of the lack of education, lack of emphasis, and all that stuff. And we know that from, you know, all the stuff around the world, whether it's air pollution, water pollution, toxins in food, toxins that they use in their own home and backyard and stuff, because of the absence of certain knowledge and so on, and the time to do it and the studies. You know, you go to university, even if you do a law degree, you'll come across stuff on toxins and you go, oh, hold on, I might need to do something. So, you know, the expanded education enables you to lower your exposure to toxins. So, you know, we've got all of those issues. So we're mass medicating the working class Australians more than anything, which is, again, another ethical issue that we need to do. And it's the aware Australians, and where are people around the world who are actually taking steps to avoid exposure to toxins and, in this case, fluoride. So hold on. Let's give people a choice, let them know, and then let them show. Now, the whole fundamental principles – sorry, you won't get a word in with me.
I've got a heap of questions to ask you, but okay, I'm in.
The fundamental principles of toxicology is that you also get a dose, and it's what's the dose-response relationship. So you get a dose of a chemical, and a little bit may not cause harm, but a little bit more may. And we know
– okay. So let's just jump on that dose for a little bit, because I guess if you look at the Australian Drinking Water Guidelines, and they specify the concentrations of sodium fluoride in drinking water. Now, I guess from an outsider's perspective, could you just say, well, surely they must have it right now. Surely the concentrations of fluoride in drinking water fall well within those guidelines. Is fluoride in these small concentrations still an issue? And why?
Okay.
Or why not?
Look, absolutely, you know. Yeah. And I'll go back to one principle. The fluoride that they add to water isn't the fluoride. So we're talking about a different type of fluoride, which is primarily an industrial waste.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It's not dirty. It's been cleaned up and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay? But it comes from industry as a waste product. It's cleaned up and put in water. It's different. The sodium fluoride products that are added to water is very different to what occurs in nature in the form of calcium fluoride. Now, the fluorine, which you hear the term fluorine. Fluorine is referring to the atomic structure of that of a particular chemical, fluorine. And when you add it to something, it becomes a fluoride. So you've got sodium fluoride, calcium fluoride. The calcium fluoride is more naturally occurring. The sodium fluoride isn't. So we're not regularly exposed to it. And so on. Now, when it comes to the safety factor, we have about 1 ppm, 1 ppm of fluoride in our water. The first problem is some people are going to get 2 or 3, and some people are going to get 0.4 or 0.5, because you just can't ensure the perfect mixing. And from the stories and even the video clips I've seen over the years, it's not done what I would say to medical standards, put it this way. Even though we're mass medicating, it's not done to good health standards. There's a little bit more of just, well, let's put a bit more in and things. And it hasn't, as far as I'm concerned, been shown to be a perfect science. So we're getting a lot of distribution of the levels. Now, the thing about susceptibility, or that level where it's people start to react, varies with everyone. And the way we normally determine that, the best way is through animal studies, because we can control it. We're not allowed to put politicians in cages and expose them to toxic chemicals or
I'm sure some people would
companies.
Like
to. You know, that's, for some reason, that's unethical. I think we need to review that, you know. By the way, that's a joke for the listeners there. What we do, though, with the animals, we can actually put them in cages and expose the exact amount of a chemical. And that way that you can get the dose-response relationship. At what dose does it manifest certain toxicological properties, certain adverse health conditions? And so we do it with mice. We do it with rats and other animals. And then we look for the human experimentation or the human epidemiology, so where we see it happening out there in nature. Now, sometimes, for example, in the workplace, we actually see an accidental experiment where people are exposed to a chemical and...
Which might be Australia right now for the last 50 years.
Yeah, well, both in the workplace and here. And we can, you know, look at that. And we can make assumptions, but most of toxicology is based on the rat experiment. But the strongest evidence always comes from human evidence, because we can never assume if we're a rat or a mouse or a hamster, or you know, which one most closely relates to us. And so we look at this and we go, okay, and we know that at around about 1 ppm, 1 part per million, toxicological symptoms start to show up in rats. At 10 parts per million, so 10 times that, a large array of toxicological symptoms occur. In fact, I'll give you some studies on rats showed that about 4% of rats develop skeletal fluorosis, which is a crystallization modeling of the bone. So it makes it a little bit more fragile and brittle and so on, and leads to problems of bones down the line. That occurs, you get 4%, 4.5, 5% of mice get that at just over 1 part per million. Now, if you put it up to about 6 parts per million, you get about 60% of the rats getting it. So you see that, you see how it goes. It's not just one little bit extra, and then you'll get a bit more of this skeletal or dental fluorosis. It's actually there. And with fluoride, it's the rare product we put in water that we know we're adding it, and we're going to see some toxic effects. And we don't have a safety factor built in. We really don't have a safety. There are people out there, and it's widely acknowledged, who have dental and skeletal bone fluorosis. So the crystallization, we know that occurring. Now, that's the obvious one. That's the most obvious one. And that's the easiest one to see. Well, at least in dental fluorosis, because you can actually see it, measure it, and do all these. Mm-hmm. All the other problems, of course, lie in the fact that these other conditions that I'll talk about in a moment, you can't see them. Yeah. You know, they're very hard to detect and so on. So we've got susceptibility. Now, infants are probably 100-plus times more susceptible to these toxic chemicals in utero, in the womb. You know, the fluoride goes through the placenta straight into the brain tissue of the embryo. And so we're locking away. And what happens, we know from studies on iron, is that a lot of those materials in the brain are actually locked away permanently, because the blood-brain barrier, which develops in those first years of life, keep the stuff in there. So once the stuff's in there, it tends to be in there. So we've got a lot of these issues, and there's, I believe, not enough safety factor for fluoride in our water. Now, America has about a year ago, I think, well, maybe 2 years ago, but given that we've just gone over Christmas, I don't know. Yep. But the US said, we've done an assessment, and I think we're putting too much fluoride, 1 ppm, in the water. And we're going to give a recommendation to lower it to about 0.6. So they're going to reduce it by 40%. And the pure reason is, for the first time, they've actually done studies, and they're showing that, hold on, dental fluorosis is occurring. Some of these conditions, the obvious conditions, are occurring. But also they're seeing that people have other sources of exposure to fluoride in their foods, in pesticides, in lots of things. You know, they're getting other sources. So they've said, hold on, let's take it down to 0.6, which is a great step. I'd like to see it at about 0.1 or 0 personally.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the first step to say, hold on, Australia's got it wrong, and we've had it wrong for now nearly 50 years. And that
Wow. So let's just have another bit chat a bit further about the health implications of, I guess, having it wrong. So we've touched on fluorosis of the teeth and the bones. Is there what else are there? I've read about, obviously, some dumbing of the population.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean,
want a better term.
Yeah. If we stick with the fluorosis one first, because it leads on to a couple of conditions. And what we've got to understand is that the fluorine molecule is very reactive, and what it does is the sodium fluoride that we put in our water and so on is reactive, goes to the bone and forms a crystal, and it actually forms a lot more. So you actually may end up with more bone density, but more brittle bone, or more tooth density, but brittle tooth. Now, the same thing actually occurs because lots of your connective tissue, things like collagen, even your skin, okay, all of this stuff, which is continually replacing so on, if it starts to take up the fluoride, it ends up with more brittle tendons and more brittle ligaments, you know, the connective tissue, and in a sense, more brittle skin, if you could imagine that, but because it's so flexible, you won't even notice on them. So it's going to lead to that one fluorosis. You almost get connective tissue fluorosis. That's not the correct term, but you can see it's all related because of the reactivity of the fluoride.
Yeah. So, and are the incidence of these, are they higher in Australia than they are in Europe or areas where the water isn't fluoridated?
In areas where they've looked at the studies, yes, they are.
Mm-hmm.
They are. There's quite a lot of evidence on in terms of the increased levels of these. But you also see it in rat experiments and animal experiments where you're exposed to it and you can see, then you can operate on the rats and you can look at the bone and you can do these scans mm-hmm. and so on a lot better than you can humans. So we've got the human yeah. and the rat experimentation show, you know, there's good evidence there. Then, of course, what you meant was very much about, okay, what about the mental or the psychological problems that we're seeing out there? Are there links? Look, there are some very, very good studies. Now, what's interesting is these studies have been around for 40 years, linking fluoride exposure with various neuropsychological, neurotoxicological problems. And it's only recently that there's been bigger studies done, what are called meta-analysis, where they bring together 3 or 4 or 24 or 34 of the studies. In fact, mm-hmm. they actually bring together hundreds of studies and then say, okay, we can only use 20 of them because 20 are good and the other 80 or 90 or 100 are biased yep. and wrong. So they do these meta-analysis and they look at it. And the meta-analysis, the first one that's been had a lot of media lately is IQ in children. Now, there are probably a dozen studies in China and Japan showing lowering of IQ in children. So we're seeing this in the populations. Okay. Now, these are, of course, epidemiological studies. So
you can't control all the factors,
And what you've got is these populations. But they've been repeated so many times now that you can make a pretty good assumption because, it shows up in the animal experimentation. When you give animals these, they end up with learning difficulties. They end up with they can actually see a part of the brain, the hippocampus. The neurons in there start to crystallize a little bit. So you can actually see some of the physical damage of it. You can see the hyperactivity in pups. You can see memory, learning, and cognitive function in rats. Obviously, they're going to measure them differently to the way they do in humans, but they see those occurring in the rats. But in the epidemiological studies, they've actually very clearly shown that increased fluoride in water is associated with an increase in a decrease in IQ. And
wow.
I think it was a Harvard study. The last meta-analysis that I looked at was done in 2013, a Harvard study, and it said, yes, there is this definite link. There is very little doubt. And the people who do this research, mostly, let me tell you a bit, scientists. They're boring. They're dull. Not me. I'm not a good atypical scientist, okay?
Well, say me. I'm a creative engineer.
They're boring. They're dull. And they don't want to be recognized other than in papers. They don't want to stand out in the media.
They just want to be pinpointed.
Yeah. And they don't want controversy. And yet these scientists in their papers are saying, yes, there is a link. And yes, we need more studies, but yes, there is a link. When a scientist says, yes, there is a link, you know there is a definite link.
Yeah, because these are risk-averse scientists and they don't say there's a link if there ain't a link.
Yeah, because they're risking their careers and they're risking a lot of fallback or flack from big companies, large, huge companies around the world, and they don't want to do that. Okay, they want to sit back in their little nest and potter away at that. So we know that. We know there's in terms of human conditions, there's a link with ADHD, attention hyperactive disorder. These are the conditions which you see. We see something like I think it's 20% of kids are now related to ADHD.
I know, it's increasing. I mean, obviously there's a lot of factors that contribute to that as well. And I guess obviously, you know, additives in food and whatever it might be, chemicals in our overall environment, and fluoride might just be one of them. But there is, and even I know, I've got a school-age child, and just the incidence, you know, Yeah. Oh, I don't need to say too much, but yeah,
there is no doubt in this spectrum, which is called the autism spectrum disorder, it's gone from something like 1 in 10,000
to 1 in 100.
No, 1 in 45.
1 in 45.
The latest stuff coming out of the US only 2-3 months ago was 1 in 45. Now let's say we're behind; we're probably 1 in 65 now. Okay. And yes, there are differences in the way we measure it now compared to 100 years ago.
We're picking it up better and it's reported better, but at the same time, a difference like that.
And also the measurement tools have pretty well been standard for the last 25 years, and we've actually seen it consistently going up to the point where they're now saying by 2050 there'll be something like 1 in 3 kids will have autism spectrum disorder. Now, again, as you said, it's not just fluoride, but fluoride plays a critical role in there. And this is where I come back to this concept of susceptibility. You see, the mice in the studies, when we do the studies, get good mice chow. They get good water. They get looked after. They get padded. They get cared for.
So you eliminate all those other factors
Absolutely.
That may contribute and bring it into a controlling environment where you're just changing the fluoride concentration.
Yep. Whereas in reality, find a kid who gets that. I can't find a kid other than my own grandkids who get good nutrition. You know, I can't. They eat crap breakfast foods. They have, you know, they have all of those processed sugary breakfast foods, no nutrition, high sugar, you know, and all that. And then so automatically all their system is challenged. They're not getting the nutrients to run their immune system, to form the bones, to develop the hormones and the neurotransmitters. They're not getting them anymore. So those kids are like putting sick rats in a chamber and exposing them to fluoride. And we don't do that experiment, but we're doing it in real life.
Oh, this is making me sad and angry. It's also too because the mums that are really and dads that are trying really, really hard to do that are often ostracized or just, you know, looked as the crazy ones or the odd ones or the ones that are ruffling feathers in their schools trying to get healthy eating policies and all this sort of stuff. You know, that's what gets me angry too.
Look, I stand up in public and say, isn't it funny that the people who are the health nuts, the health freaks, are the ones looking after the health, and the normal people who are sick and now develop diabetes at 25 are the normal ones. I don't want to be normal.
Yeah.
I'm a health nut.
I don't want to be normal either.
I'm a health nut. You know,
I'm with you.
I'm fanatical because there is nothing more important about health. So anyway, going back, susceptibility, the kids out there are being exposed to so much crap along the way, so little nutrition, and they're being exposed to fluoride on top of it. So inevitably, yes, it is going to cause problems, and it's linked with dyslexia, cognitive impairment, IQ, all those things. You know, so we know there is a link. We know that we know some of the biochemistry of it. It's been published in medical journals like Lancet, as you know. Every year there's a couple more studies in the medical journals and the environmental journals and all that highlighting it. So we've got the evidence.
Okay. We've got the evidence. And if the health implications of fluoride consumption are so great, what the hell is it doing in our drinking water? If the health benefits of tooth decay are perceived to be greater, or the health benefits of eliminating tooth decay are perceived to be greater than that of fluoride consumption. But then we're saying we're even questioning whether fluoride is even helping to protect against tooth decay if the root cause is our diet.
Yep.
So, I mean, there's so many questions, but yeah, are the health risks of tooth decay greater than fluoride consumption?
Well, you know, this is where I come to a point where we have this debate about, is fluoride beneficial for tooth decay? And some people will say, hold on, I know that story where I lived in a town, and no fluoride and they had poor tooth decay. However, I can tell you right now.
Yeah. I can tell you right now that the diet of most of those kids getting their teeth extracted is shit, for want of a better word.
Exactly. So you're not controlling, but I've been in towns that have fluoride and they've got the worst teeth compared to the towns that don't have fluoride and they've got the better teeth. Because so you can't, as an individual, we can't make these assumptions. So we've just got to look at the evidence. Yeah. And there's a process called the Cochrane Review. Now, without going into detail, this is a systematic way of reviewing all the literature, getting rid of the trash, getting rid of the junk, getting rid of the bad science. And yes, most of the science out there is bad science. It really is, because it's got vested interest. If you've got vested interest, if someone's paying for it, if a drug company, if a fertilizer company is paying for it, if the government's paying for it, they're paying for it because they expect an outcome, and that outcome will occur. The Cochrane Review, it was just last year, came out, led by a Norwegian scientist. I've forgotten his name. I emailed, we spoke on well, we contacted on email a few times, and the Cochrane Review very, very clearly came down and said that 98% of those studies showing the benefits in tooth decay and fluoride are extremely flawed and strong vested interests.
But who has invested interest in that, though?
Oh, government. People, the people who want to get rid of fluoride, the dentists who have a moral, or they've got a history of supporting it and don't want to all of a sudden be seen to be showing. So there are all these bodies behind there that, you know, once you've invested, when I talk about vested interests, I talk about largely money. But once you've invested a lifetime career in a position, in your 7 years study, in your research and all that, it's very hard for people to turn around and say, no, I'm wrong. We don't like
being wrong. Yeah, now chatting about that, do you think that is one of the main reasons why our governments aren't taking action? Because they don't want to look dumb or stupid for doing something that's now been proven, you know, look back and say, okay, well, we've done this for 50 years, but we'll just quietly take it out of the water now and life will just go on. Or do you think by taking it out, they're worried that it might open them up to a lawsuit? From, you know, or class actions or something like that. I don't know. Is that the worry?
No, I don't think you can open them to class action or lawsuits for the very simple reason they're taking out an additive that they put in, and any person can still choose to take it if they want. So you can get fluoride tablets. You can go and get, you know, they can prepare fluoride for you to drink and your family to drink if you want. But then it's an individual's choice.
So why is it still in our water then? Do you think that no one wants to lose face, or they're just waiting for more evidence or more countries to do it, and then Australia will say, oh, we'll follow suit now?
Look, I think it is inevitable. You see it in Queensland, discussion and debate going on it, but I think the federal government will step in and try to mandate it because they don't want to be seen. But the reality is, we trust governments and we think, oh, hold on, they've got it right. Let me tell you, they haven't. Another topic of mine is cholesterol-lowering drugs. I can tell you very openly, cholesterol-lowering drugs lower cholesterol, but they've never saved a single life. And the government puts $1 billion towards them in the pharmaceutical benefit scheme. You think they do their homework, and yet I can show you hundreds of scientific papers to show that the drugs don't work, and yet they keep doing it. Once you've invested a lifetime, a career, whatever it is, you've got vested interest in there, and you'll make sure. Now, there's also a lot of money involved. We're still talking millions, hundreds of millions of dollars and things like that along the way. So when it comes to fluoride, there are these strong vested interests. And yes, it is a problem. Now, the biggest problem in all this, as I was talking about toxicology, we haven't even begun to touch on the surface of what happens to the next generation caused by this generation's exposure to fluoride, something called epigenetics. We haven't
Have we got there yet, or it's happening right now in our younger kids now, isn't it? Because I guess I'm the generation that drank fluoridated water in the 70s and 80s. Not now. I've lived in a town for the last 11 years where fluoride isn't added to the water, and prior to that I lived in North Queensland and I filtered my water. But still, people typically my age are having children now would have had the two generations being fluoridated in Australia.
And in the case of what I mentioned, epigenetics, it's our genes don't change, but what happens is our expressions of our genes change. And we now know, and we see it with fluoride, that it alters the expression of some genes. What the outcome is in the next five generations, we don't know, but we see it altering the expressions of genes. Again, fluoride is an incredibly reactive, when you mix, it's very reactive. So it can alter the DNA, we know that, but it can also alter the expression of that DNA. And that's what we don't understand. And now we're only, as I said earlier, just starting to understand all these neurotoxicological conditions because we've just started looking into it. And the problem is we're basing all of the let's keep adding fluoride to water on 1950s science, 1950s attitude, and 1950s toxicology. The modern toxicologist is saying, well, hold on, let's look at what's happening. Not now, not just now, but next generation, effectively 200 years on. And we know some chemicals, for example, can literally alter that expression of the genes to make people sicker five generations on, so 100 years on or something. So we've really got to go back and take, well, hold on, we don't know enough. We just, my basic premise, we just don't know enough. And any person...
What happened to the precautionary principle? Yeah.
Any person who says, oh, yes, we do, I'm sorry, they're idiots. They're idiots. We just do not know enough. And there is enough evidence clearly to say it's time to regulate, get rid of the fluoride in water, give people the choice if they want to take it, that's fine. Make the fluoride available for people who want it. But if they don't, then, you know, take it out of the water. We I haven't even, for example, touched on cancers. There's some interesting research on cancers, and this was done, I think, back in 2005, where the original study showed no link with bone cancer, osteosarcoma, a particular rare form of bone cancer, no link. However, when they stratified the information and they looked at boys through that rapid growing period of bone growth, you know how boys go, you know, girls will go a bit faster earlier and then boys just zap and...
they got hollow legs. Yeah, I've got two sons. They just, they eat nonstop for 2 weeks and they grow a meter.
Roughly. They actually stratified the data and they looked at that, and between the period, I think it was the most sensitive period appeared to be about 8 years of age. But there was a dramatic and significant rise in these bone cancers in these young boys. No other, not the females, not the older boys, not the even infants, but in that growth period of bone development. So, you know, there's all this stuff that's coming up, and, you know, you can't ignore it. You've got to err on the side of caution and say, okay, let's get rid of fluoride.
Okay, so let's chat about getting rid of fluoride at the moment. So if it's still going to be in our, I guess, our potable water, our drinking water coming to our house, what options are available for people to filter or treat their supply? Or I guess, is drinking rainwater the best option? But then some people in Australia live in very low rain environments, like, hello, that's me. But then I guess our water, our local water isn't fluoridated, although there are moves to try and make it that way. So how can the average Australian get it out of their water?
Okay, let's deal with some of those issues. Rainwater isn't necessarily a great option, okay? I think rainwater should be filtered. Not for fluoride, but if you're surrounded by farms and bits and pieces, you're going to have more pesticides in that water. But also there's and this I haven't seen any written evidence of this, but I've been speaking with some specialists in the area of infectious diseases. Mm-hmm. And there's this growing incidence of people who are picking up protozoan microbes. These are little microbes, smaller than bacteria and so on, and they're causing hell for these people. So I mean, and I got into this because a friend of mine nearly died, and they worked out what it was, and you know, it's taken him a year to get it under control. So drinking water from rainwater has its own issues.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, great, but it has to be filtered too. Now, the second principle is, okay, how do we get rainwater? I'd like to live up in the hills and get that beautiful crystalline creek running through, and that's probably about the best bet. But if we don't, then we've got to rely on the main source. And then the best thing then is to filter it. Now, when it comes to filtering, most people will probably think of Brita filters, okay?
Yeah.
They'll think of the ones you get through your Woolworths, Coles, Kmart, wherever they are. You can buy those. And the reality is, they're moderately effective for chlorine.
But not for fluoride.
They don't touch
all.
Fluoride.
Yeah.
So you're getting the one that smells the most. The chlorine smell is the one where you're, you know, in a shower, you smell it, and drinking water, you'll smell it. It gets rid of most of that. It gets rid of a few of the heavy metals, might be lead and maybe a bit of mercury here and there, and other things that may be contaminating water. And this stuff does contaminate our water. There is no doubt, okay?
Yeah. Well, that's mainly obviously from our old pipes and things like that. So copper, I think, is one of the bigger ones too that comes through.
And that's interesting because copper, because of the fluoride, copper is made more available in the water. So you're getting both fluoride and copper. So there's this whole other area one day we need to talk about how it can react in the water to create these other contaminants in there. But the message is, you know, you want to get rid of them. And there are some filters on the market. Now, there are some very expensive ones, and they're supposed to, you know, do all these whiz-bang things with the water. They'll take out the fluoride and things, and they do whiz-bangs. They're far too expensive. You can actually now get filters for under $200 that can remove 85. Some of them, the majority, there's only one I know that does 100%, but it's and they're just passive. So you can run them through, put the water on. I've got one in my house, so I can tell you right now, and all our family have it. And you put it on and it runs through, and in 40, 50 seconds, you've got a jug full of water. And it's put taken all the stuff out, everything out, and it's remineralized and revitalized the water.
Another, okay, so it's not a reverse osmosis, because I've spoken to some water treatment people, and they say obviously I thought reverse osmosis was needed to fully get fluoride out of water.
Yep.
But in a household environment, you can't have a reverse osmosis treatment plan or anything like that.
This is where I come to. The strategy in the past has always been to the only way you can do it is really through distillation. You know, you're boiling the water.
Mm-hmm. And getting the condensate off it.
Which is awkward and so on. Or reverse osmosis, which is where they push water molecules through very, very small holes. And the water goes through and nothing else does. But you end up with 3/4 of the water being wasted, which you put on your garden or wherever if you don't, but otherwise it goes down the sink. It's quite energy intensive and reasonably expensive. So you can get units for your home on that. Mm-hmm. You can get units for, you know, your kitchen top or under the bench stuff. And that's one. My irking with reverse osmosis is that in most cases you're taking everything out of the water, so you're ending up with pure H2O and nothing else.
Now, so you're taking all the good bits out as well.
Minerals.
Yeah.
So if anyone has reverse osmosis, make sure they put the goodies back in the water. And you might say, Pete, but it's only a little bit of mineral. No, it's actually very important because it's in what's called a colloidal form, in a form that your body can absorb really rapidly and nicely, and it comes in there and it helps you feel quenched because sometimes you may feel that you can drink a lot of water, and it just seems to go through you. Well, that's what will happen with water that doesn't have any minerals in it. So the more minerals in water, the more you retain it, you feel quenched, and it satisfies your thirst more. So you want the minerals back in the water. So if you've got reverse osmosis, and some of the suppliers I know do have, capsules and things that put back the minerals. It doesn't take much. You just got to put it back in there. But the best one is, again, as far as I'm concerned, is the jug for convenience. We do a lot of travel around the country doing talks and things, and we carry a jug. We've got a desktop one. It's a bit of a dome shape, a little bit bigger than about the size of a small microwave.
Well, I'll make sure that we get the names of these, and I'll link in the bottom of the podcast so people can just click straight on and suss them out and see if they're able to get them in their own homes as well.
The good thing about this technology is that it used to be 85%, and there's probably maybe a half a dozen, maybe even more companies, probably around the world 30. In Australia, there were 2 or 3 who did 85% fluoride, but now you can get 100 or pretty well close. You know, they can't say 100, but in the original experiments, 100, and it'll decline over, you know, the 6 months or so on to 97%. And as far as I'm concerned, that's fine. It's about reducing that exposure.
So how does that jug work? It's not a charcoal or a carbon, or how's it filtering it?
Look, it's every jug has multiple layers, maybe 6 or so, and it starts off with, you know, a paper one, getting the big bits out. Then it works with usually some sand and some activated carbon that you know, take out the chlorine and other bits and pieces, and it goes down and down and down. And the fluoride filter is a synthetic material. And I know when I first started looking into these jugs that the synthetic material, you can develop the material from two sources. One is aluminium, which I don't necessarily recommend because, hey, you will get trace. Yep. And the other one was an algae, a material derived from algae. And it was really funny because when you started using these jugs, you've got this fishy taste. You know, and you go, oh, no. But you run the water through, the fishy taste disappears. And so does the chlor. So many people I know have told me this fishy taste, and so you get rid of the fishy taste after the first you run 10 liters through it, and then you get it. But now the material has been improved, as I said, and they can remove up to 100%. And it's a synthetic. I'm not sure I haven't traced it back yet, but it's a synthetic material, and it does around about 100% of the fluoride. And but I think you still get some of that fishy taste if you're not careful.
That's all right. I'll get all that information and the links and everything. I'll pop it in the show notes so people can go and check it out. Now I'm going to ask you another question. I'm going to put you on the spot a bit here, because I haven't told you that I was going to ask this. But as you know, being obviously you're an environmental scientist, environmental engineer, I absolutely hate the obsession that our population has with with our bottled water.
Mm.
So, and buying, you know, multiple yep. bottles of bottled water a day or whatever when they're traveling and stuff like that. And I'd really like to see people drinking good quality water out of a reusable drinking water, drinking bottle, whether it's a glass bottle or a stainless steel bottle. Now, if, like I said, the biggest obstacle I'm finding that people are having to breaking, you know, or not buying bottled water is their, you know, concerns about fluoride. But should we also be having concerns about people drinking water out of plastic bottles?
Yes.
Like, is that not just as much of a health issue as drinking tap water with fluoride?
Well, let's start with the environmental issue first of these bottles.
I know. We may need another whole hour to talk about this. But I'm thinking, you're worried about fluoride, yet you're drinking water in a plastic bottle.
I think, was it San Francisco recently banned bottled water? They're banning it over a period of a year or two. Look, and we need it's crazy. And if you go to a third world country, it's just everywhere. Plastic bottles. And here's my stance on this. If you've got plastic bottles, you've got any bottles, they have to be recycled like they do in South Australia. The only reason they're not recycled in South Australia with a refund and they're not done the rest around Australia is because of money, vested interests of the large bottling companies and the food companies and the drink companies who put pressure on the governments and put pressure on all the independent people who are saying, let's do it. So, again, vested interest. But my preference is still to get rid of bottles, lower it. And my take on water, I was actually writing a book on water years ago, so, you know, I've had some time to think about it. You haven't caught me on the hop here. But the reality is there are many contaminants that you're going to pick up from the plastic water bottle. And what started me on this journey was seeing, this bottled water being transported around, stuck in the sunlight for a day or two, warming up.
On the back of a truck.
And in shops and outside shops and all this. And the more heat, the more warmth, the more sunlight, the more this plastic reacts and releases these chemicals. Phthalates is a group of chemicals. Bisphenol.
Bisphenols.
Yep, yeah. your bisphenol A, your bisphenol, all these other ones that are now, you know, we're looking. Things like antimony. Which is a toxic element, which is used in some of the production of some of the plastics and so on, can be released into the water. And there was a couple of issues where they had fairly high antimony levels about 10 years ago. But you've got all these things going in a bottle of water because it's just sitting there in the water. Plastic isn't inert. It's not glass. It's not stainless steel. It's not, you know, these materials. And you get a lot, depending on the heat, the conditions, the sunlight. And, of course, you see all these kids going to school with their water bottles, plastic water bottles, and there they are in their backpack warming up all day. And I'm from Perth and you're from, you know, South Australia. So
the inside of the car here, just temperatures this summer, we've had 48 degree days, but inside a car, I don't know, 60, 70, 80 degrees plus. Well, yeah, you actually can't drink the water. It's too hot.
Yeah.
And but actually the cold water out of our taps burns your hands on those days.
So anyway, from the plastic concept, you're getting all these plasticizers, plastic chemicals going into the water. Mm. And so the message is you want to avoid it. You really do want to. And the new bottles are the ones with the highest concentrations of these in because they're just manufactured. For that one use situation. Now, the one use situation too is a 1950s attitude. Get rid of it. You know,
it's ridiculous.
Use stainless steel bottles. I don't have a problem with aluminium, by the way, in bottles. Mm. People say, "Oh, but linked with Alzheimer's." Not in water bottles. It's only when it's cooked with. Another topic. You know, but getting with something that's not going to be as reactive as plastic and leave these behind and stop buying. And here's my last one. And if we stop buying soft drinks, we'd get rid of tooth decay and obesity in our kids overnight. So how
that was my next point. But the soft drink companies own the bottled water and they price the bottled water higher than the soft drinks. Yeah. So if you're in a shop and you're seeing a $3 bottle of water or a $2 can of a soft drink, people, you know, again, working class may not have as much money, might be choosing the cheaper option.
Yeah.
I will not swear on a podcast, but it's
criminal.
It is
criminal.
Good.
Look, this is all based on, we need to do what we've done with tobacco. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I was involved in some of that control over here. It was our research, my group's research, which I led, which led to the banning of tobacco smoke in hotels and so on over in Western Australia. So we did a study of 40 hotels and things, and the results very clearly said it's there no matter what. And I was involved with, you know, the some of the regulation earlier on through a group called ACOSH, and we. The same principles we need to apply to soft drinks, to water bottles. All of that stuff is just old stuff, and we need to move on. We have to become an aware and educated population. But unfortunately, if you have too much fluoride, you're not going to be aware. In fact, I'd say all water needs to be, if you're living in remote towns, you might have higher levels of nitrates in the water, and you know there are all these other things. So it's really a matter of saying, okay, let's take a precaution. It's inexpensive, you know, it's 3 or 4 cents a litre to run it through these jugs and things. So it's incredibly cost effective.
Yep, and just let's start investing in our health a little bit more and the health of our environment, because I really want to get those plastic water bottles out of our beautiful country. All right. Well, is there anything that we haven't discussed about fluoride or that I haven't asked you that you'd like to add today, Peter?
Oh, look, this. Do you want me to go on for another hour?
Probably not. No, look, unless there's something really, really key.
I've given the stuff up. You know, so much information. I mean, one thing that comes to mind too is things like baby formula.
Yeah, I was reading about that too, because if you're mixing that with your drinking water, you're giving your baby a higher dose as well.
Yeah, they're getting about 100 times more than what they would through breast milk, and that's a little bit scary. Now, my first thing is, first of all, I'm giving a talk this Friday about eat your way to health, okay? And one of my first lines is there is only one superfood. It's human milk. Forget all that's these true. Other things. Okay, they're good. Mm. They're really great to have kale and your blueberries and almonds. They're fantastic foods. They're great foods, but the only superfood is breast milk. And the world average for breastfeeding, and that's not fully breastfed, but up to 4.2 years of age. And here in Australia, the average is about 3 months.
Yeah, that's right.
And unfortunately, we think, you know, there is nothing more important than investing in your own health and the health of your infants.
But it's the health of the mother too. Obviously with my prior business, Sustainer Baby, working with a lot of new mums, and obviously I'm a breastfeeding advocate and breastfeeding mother myself. But there's so much. Yeah, it's a tough topic because there is a lot of guilt attached and a lot of mourning for mothers that haven't been able to, or grief is probably the right word. So some mothers that desperately do want to breastfeed for the health of their children and weren't able to for whatever reasons as well. Or lack of support, it's a really tough one. I totally agree with you that it's the only superfood out there, but it's we got to get those rates up.
Yep, and the only and again going back to fluoride, you know, mothers think it's okay. It's not the one, you're going to get extra fluoride, but two, you're never going to get the same food and quality and probiotics and prebiotics that you get in breast milk, so human milk. Mm. So at the end of the day, let's get back to some really basic concepts. In the 50s, we shunned women away from that type of stuff. Mm. In the 2016, let's push people let's get back to some really basic health concepts. Yeah. There is nothing more important than our health. Nothing.
Nothing. All right, let's eat real food, feed our babies their real food, and drink real water.
Yep.
Thanks very much for your time,
Peter. Absolute pleasure, Laura.
So thanks again, Peter. For all our listeners today that are keen to find a little bit more about you and the work you do, where can we best find you online?
Well, look, the best place is obviously my website, which is just www.drdingle.com, drdingle.com.
Thanks again, Peter.
Well, there you have it, listeners. You've now heard both the cases for and against the addition of fluoride to our drinking water supply. And while both of my guest experts sit on different sides of the fence, they clearly both agree that we should be doing everything we can to clean up our diets and just eat real food. Stay tuned to the next episode, which is part 3 of this installment, where I'll provide a short summary of the issues, plus give you an overview on how you can filter your water should this be something you'd like to pursue. In the meantime, if you haven't yet headed to lauratrotter.com/fluoride to get your copy of the free download for this feature, make sure you do so you have everything at your fingertips. And if you've loved this feature, I'd really appreciate it if you left a review in iTunes. Every episode of EcoChat takes me hours of time to produce. Of course, I absolutely love doing this, but talking into a mic in my lounge room can get a little bit lonely at times. And while I can see the hundreds of you who download the episodes each month, I'd love a review as a token of your thanks. So to do this, you'll need to open up the podcast in iTunes and click to the Ratings and Reviews tab to leave your review. It really only takes 2 minutes, and your review will help so many more people find my podcast and the important information I have to share. So please, I'd love it if you left a review, preferably 5 stars, of course. And when you do, tag me in Instagram at lauratrotter.com so I can thank you personally. So that's all from me today. Now go out there and help make green mainstream. Thanks for listening to the EcoChat podcast. I'm Laura Trotter. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love you to subscribe, share with your friends, and leave a review in iTunes. And if you're keen to continue the conversation, head on over to my website, lauratrotter.com, where you can also pick up your free copy of my e-guide, 11 Steps to Ecofy Your Home and Your Life. Catch you there.